This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Good.
Very, very well. Back again.
All right.
Yes, we are. We had lost the audio. We had some technical difficulties one show ago. And so we're actually going to do the same exact questions, and we're going to hope the, we know the brilliance is going to come out somehow, but...
What were the nature of those technical difficulties? I'm just curious about what specifically went wrong.
You know, I don't know. The details are a little bit unclear. But all I can say is that the audio got lost. We tried to recover it. A number of Beat Your Genes listeners actually did reach out to me. I posted on the Facebook site, and they offered to help. And I sent them the audio. They tried as much as they could, but we just had some difficulties. And that's all I know.
No, this is Jen Hawk wanting to make it clear that I messed it up.
I'm glad Doug understood where I was coming from there. That was not an earnest, good faith question.
Oh my goodness.
No. It's Doug's fault. Let's just be clear.
Fault. Yeah.
How's the bus look from under there, Dr. Lyle?
Oh my goodness.
All right.
Speaking of technical difficulties, I have to give a shout out to a certain Horace, who I'm sure is listening, who went to the trouble of sending me a better microphone, which I am not using for this episode because I can't figure out how to make it work. So he sent, you know, it's here. I've been messing with it. I'm not sure if I have like a faulty unit and I need to replace it or if it's user error. I've tried it a couple different ways with a couple different machines. So I'm working on it, Horace. Next episode, I promise.
That's right. All right.
So we're still stuck with the crappy audio. I apologize.
All right. Fair enough. Good job.
No worries.
All right, Nathan, what do we got?
All right. So our first question, dear doctors, dear doctors, are attachment styles just the latest trend in psychodynamic nonsense, or is there some legitimacy to it?
Well, I'll just answer. Attachment styles are not new. Okay, this goes back to John Bowlby in the early 20th century, and then through him, I believe a grad student of his was Mary Ainsworth, who then became a distinguished professor of developmental psychology at the University of Virginia, and then she did empirical work on this for her whole career and had legions of graduate students, you know, for 40 or 50 years doing this work. However, there's more than one question, which is that are there differences in how what you might call attachment styles? And the answer is yes. Okay. Do those differences have anything to do with any psychodynamic process between parent and child? No, they don't. So that is where there's no legitimacy at all to that. But you can certainly tell that, and there's no use calling it attachment styles. It's just personality. So you've got people that are inherently neurotic, and that those are going to be sort of what you would call an anxious attachment type of a person in Ainsworth's, you know, three categories. And that's the long and short of this is there's no utility at all in even thinking about things in terms of attachment styles. Yet, is there legitimacy to the categories of attachment style? Yes, but only insofar as they are correlated with what we know to be under there, which is the big five. And so upbringing has absolutely nothing to do with this. This is entirely genetic variation. So that's that. Anything we need to say about that, Jen, or is that it?
Yeah, I remember when we did this last time, it was sort of like, this is called personality. Okay, yeah. Next question.
Yes.
Sort of like there's not much more to say. I did go on a rant, which is worth sort of recreating a little bit, where it really frustrates me that this is old news, old discredited news in a new tarted up package. And so this is the bread and butter of the psychobabble Instagram social media set, where everything, if you as I spend way more time than I'd like than I'd like to admit, or that I would like to spend at all scrolling sort of pop psychology on Instagram, just hate scrolling because it's just so amazingly frustrating and bizarre and just completely at odds with everything that we know to be true of the world. But this is what these people do, is they traffic in things like attachment theory and everything else that they can kind of repackage, and it appeals to people being told something in a personality sized, bite-sized package that suits their needs at the moment. So there's a lot of bad information out there and a lot of people profiting on this idea. And the idea, I mean, everybody who has been in more than one relationship has seen how dynamic their attachment style can be based on how rewarded they are in the relationship. So somebody who has kind of a personality that is baseline pretty avoidant or neurotic, or however we want to big five frame that is going to be responsive to their position of power in the relationship. So if they're typically a very avoidant attachment style, but they're really over rewarded by their partner, they're not going to be that avoidant at all. They're going to be much clingier than they usually are, and vice versa. If they're usually, a little more anxious, all of these things can move in concert with what kind of cues they're getting from the other person and what it is that they're looking to get from the other person and from the relationship. That's going to very much inform your so-called attachment style. So it's just like any other quality of the big five, where you have a repertoire or a potential repertoire of behaviors, and kind of personality thresholds for these traits that are going to move within a range depending on the environmental incentives and constraints that are coming at you at any given time. If you want to package it up in a cute little book that sells people on some new attachment theory or style that helps you sell books and build a following on Instagram, then I suppose more power to you, but you're not providing anything really useful in the world.
Except, of course, the Myers-Briggs.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. So people are also, there's something very, something interesting, economical about what people are hoping to do, which is to essentially place personalities in categories rather than understanding people's are combinations of dimensions. Combinations of dimensions is much more difficult to deal with than just say, oh, well, that's a Sagittarius, okay? I.e., you're a type, okay? Or, oh, you're an anxious attachment type, okay? So, no, people are constellations of genes, and those genes can be essentially understood in terms of your individual differences in your psychology. They can be the big five plus IQ. And then, as Jen's saying, from within that, like I've always talked about, the mafia chieftain, who is an unbelievable sociopath, can get incredibly humble and pleasant if I have a 45 aimed at his forehead. Okay? So that doesn't make him pleasant and humble. It just makes him, it's within his repertoire to be able to act that way if it's in his best interest. That's all.
Situationally aware.
Yes. That's it.
Well, this also gets used by people who don't want to look at the ugly truth of their reciprocal esteem dynamic in a relationship. And if they are seeing some rejection cues, for example, it's much more status saving to say, oh, well, he has an avoidant attachment type because of, childhood patterns that, I learned this on social media following my favorite psychologist. depressed. And so, you know, he wasn't cuddled enough as a child, and he didn't learn to bond properly. And so he has avoidant attachment style. And that's why he's not returning my calls. You know, it's sort of like...
Right. There.
A very, very convenient... same thing with narcissists. You know, you have this kind of whole cottage industry of, you know, oh, well, narcissistic personality disorder. And that's why these people are, you know, treating you the way that they're treating you within a relationship, instead of just coming to terms with the fact that you're dealing with kind of just a malignant, disagreeable personality in general. And that, you know, you're going to try to pathologize it and give it childhood origins.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of Mo's hacking is showing up on the mic.
Not
hopefully
much.
Not too much, but he's lots of hairballs back there.
Yeah. Yeah. The irony is the dynamic people, didn't go back far enough. You got to go back to conception.
Okay. Right. That's right.
Where
it's not the
everybody.
Childhood. It's the meeting of the genes.
That's exactly what it is.
Wonderful.
All right, Nathan.
All right.
Roll.
Okay. Our next one. I like to watch, hear you guys, wind out on this. All right. Dear doctors, wanted to get your perspectives on the trait of confidence. Do you view confidence as a combination of big five traits? Is there such a thing as internal confidence, or is it all driven by market feedback with respect to mates, friends, and training partners? I'm particularly interested in understanding if there are ways to help children feel more confident.
Well, want me to just answer, Jen?
Yeah, give your. I think last time you sort of gave. Yeah, we'll pretty much just replicate what we did last time. I think we wound up talking quite a bit about rearing children last time as part of this answer. But I remember your basics were very good. So if you can replicate those, that'll be useful.
Yeah, we'll see. Okay. Well, first of all, as we try to answer this question for this person, and they're worried, they're thinking about their kids. Okay. First of all, your kids, to the extent that confidence is genetic in origin, there's not a damn thing we can do about it. So we're kind of done. So we'll just check that box, okay? So that confidence is going to be, confidence is most correlated, what it really is it's in any given situation, it is a, it's a derivative of the calculation of your perceived probability of success. Now, the perceived probability of success, that's a detailed set of circumstances that were involved here. So what do we perceive to be success? Okay, so we already have to have a goal that's involved here that has to be delineated. And so now the person is computing their perceived probability of the success. And the result of that computation will be a feeling, essentially a sense of motivation. In other words, should I invest time and energy in this, or are the odds of loss the losses are too great? In other words, both the time and energy that could be lost, or if it's something where there could be actual additional status losses or physical losses that would result, then that would also impede me from or inhibit me from continuing. But that's what motivation is a feeling of wanting to make a bunch of moves that change from the circumstances I'm in now to the circumstances that I could envision that I would be. So a person has perceived probability of success, and a derivative of that perceived probability is this feeling of motivation that it's worth pursuing. And the higher the perceived probability of success and the higher the value of the situation, well, actually, the higher perceived probability of success, irrespective of the value of the target, that is going to result in a feeling that we recognize with the word confidence. Now, there are going to be people who inherently may not be particularly ambitious, and so therefore they don't reach very high relative to what they might be capable of doing genetically, just not particularly ambitious. And as a result, they may spend a lot of their lives pretty confident because they're really never doing anything that's that challenging. Fair enough. Okay. That's genetic. In other words, it's genetic in the sense that they're not just particularly that ambitious. So I had a friend of mine who got himself through USC Medical School, and he hasn't done a damn thing since. He's a psychiatrist, okay? And he just sits in the prison system, and sits right there, and he's a handsome guy, and he just basically sits right there. That was his first job, was in the prison system, actually as part of his, residency. And then he just never left. He just sat on his ass right there for the rest of the ride. Pretty amazing. I mean, I'm looking at an energy conservation system, you know, really a superior energy conservation system. So I don't know that my friend has really had hardly any moments of his life that he didn't feel confident because he never did anything that was pushing his abilities. So, you know, as a parent, you know, good luck trying to tell your kid, listen, just get those expectations down and don't do anything that stretches you and you'll get to feel confident your whole damn life. No, I don't think that's what you want. And that's not what you're saying. What you want is you're wanting your kid to feel confident as they reach for things that are difficult and challenging where they win big chips. Well, guess what? The only way that that's going to happen is if they are beautiful, athletic, intelligent, socially capable superstars. Oh, well.
A little disagreeable. I think you can be all of those things. And if you're not disagreeable, if you're still going to have self-doubt.
Right.
So, yes.
Right.
And so there is kind of the disagreeable, you know, wild card in
right.
this mix where
yeah.
you can be very incompetent.
Yes.
And have no real reason to be confident in life. But you're sufficiently disagreeable that mm-hmm. you just go ahead and feel like you're God's gift anyway.
Absolutely. No doubt. So right on target, Jen. That's great. So anyway, bottom line is the only confidence that we should be interested in is the following confidence. And that is the confidence coming about from the only confidence we're interested in is when we're getting an indication of low confidence, when the person is pursuing a goal because their adaptive unconscious has computed that this is a reasonable goal for them to attempt. However, they are feeling intimidated as a result of the set of circumstances that they have begun the process of attempting to hit milestones or sub-goals involved in this goal, but they're not coming easily and the feedback isn't that great. And so as a result, they are recomputing whether or not this is something that they can do. And those recomputations, what are transpiring there is a reduced perceived probability of success. And so what's happening is we're tapping the brakes on the motivational system because the motivational system is saying, hey, I'm not sure we can do this. And we have to recompute the cost benefit. Okay. And then you watch your kid as your kid is deciding maybe they're going to opt out and bail out of a challenge. And you're saying, oh, well, I thought that was probably a reasonable challenge for you to attain. And now I see that you're having some struggles and I want you to, you know, what I want is I want you to feel confident. Okay. Why do I want you to feel confident? Well, because I would like you to actually succeed at this and therefore win a bunch of genetic chips for the team. Okay. So that's what I want. So I want my kid to feel confident because I know how good it feels to feel confident. Well, if your kid does not feel confident, it's because they're running computations on the evidence that have come as a result of them trying to hit milestones. So there's nothing to, you know, we don't get them to feel more confident. They either do or they don't, depending upon the feedback. Okay, now, so what transpires from all this with respect to good parenting, good coaching, good psychotherapy, or anything else? It comes from an analysis of whether or not the goal is actually appropriate with respect to the individual. And if it turns out they bit off more than they can chew, then hey, we have to just let them flounder and find out the hard way. That's fine. Okay.
And it's actually essential that they find out the hard way. I mean, if you don't let them find out the hard way because you want to spare them the distress of the, you know, falling on their face, essentially, by, you know, having low confidence and going into it and failing, that's what parents don't want their kid to experience. And so they go to great lengths to try to prevent them from experiencing that suffering. But if they don't have the chance to calibrate appropriately, then they never calibrate properly. And then they come into adulthood anxious messes who were afraid to do anything and ego trapped in every direction because they are so afraid to fail because they've never failed and built the resilience that comes from failing and recovering and calibrating and proceeding from there, which is what you're supposed to do. So parents, these very well-intended parents who are trying to quote unquote build confidence, i.e. get them to succeed or feel like a success no matter what, you are sparing your kid from the short-term failure and feeling bad for a little while, but that comes at the cost of them being much less capable going further into their lives and into adulthood.
Yeah, all good. So all I really want to do is do the following, and that is whatever it is that they're trying to achieve, I'm going to be asking them, okay, like, what do we think the fundamentals are? Okay, so, you know, and what are we getting upset about other people achieving that we're not achieving? And so we're going to point to those people and we're going to look at them and we're going to find out, well, what are they doing that's better than what you're doing? What are the components of this achievement that we're, you know, where can we improve? So we're going to be essentially going down through that. And then when we find out that, oh, gee, it's going to take a whole bunch of work that we may not be willing to do, but our successful competitors must have done. They either have done that or they are genetically more, you know, blessed than we are. But one way or the other, if we're going to compete and reach the level that we thought that we were headed for, what the whole enterprise was aimed at, and it turns out it's more work than we thought it was, oh, well, then we may well abandon the goal, which is completely legitimate. Why did we abandon it? Lack of confidence, okay? Lack of confidence basically said, hey, this isn't worth it. I spent 1 year in my freshman year of college attempting to be a major college basketball player. And so I spent that year on that team as a red shirt flunky at the University of Idaho. And at the end of that time, I'm like, I'm done. There's absolutely no way I'm going to be a major college basketball player. I was a very fine high school player, and I'm still pretty good at the gym, even against the young guys. It's nice and surprising to go out there with my gray hair and still play with these kids. But no, I was never major college material, but I didn't know that until I went there and got my teeth kicked in. And then once you get your teeth kicked in, it's like, okay, fair enough. No problem. And we found our limit and we moved on. There's no tragedy at all. And zero, as Jen is saying, in finding your limits.
Dr. Lau, was there a particular basketball player or opponent that you remember?
Oh, yeah. Donnie Newman. Donnie Newman, who wound up two years later or so being the final cut of the Boston Celtics.
Okay. Oh, wow.
So he almost made the NBA. So, but Donnie Newman ran all over me in practice. It wasn't close, people. So anyway, that's how that goes.
Wonderful.
All right.
It's an interesting idea that there is this personality type, like your friend, the psychiatrist in the prison system, who is, living life very confidently, but never really building the self-esteem that comes from pushing your limits, from sort of stretching the confidence and doing something that you're pretty sure you're going to be able to do, but you're not totally sure you're going to be able to do it. And so that's the only space in which pride can be generated. Pride only comes about. Pride is really a more intuitive way of talking about self-esteem, just being proud of yourself. And you can only be proud of yourself if you have done something that you weren't entirely sure you were going to be able to pull off, but you did it anyway. But somebody like that with that personality doesn't, can sail through life without pushing themselves in that way and doesn't have that sort of innate yearning for a self-esteem process that so many of us do. And it seems, content enough.
Yeah. And that I have to say, that's great, Jen. That is when I'm looking at my friend and I'm thinking about him, his natural experience in life is so different than my own. Like, yeah. My natural experience in life, as is yours, as are many people that we talk to, we have in us a risk-taking, go for broke, kind of mentality where we want to really do something and find out what we're capable of doing. And my friend, Pleasant as hell, by the way. Just unbelievably pleasant character. But it's like there's no fight in it. You know what I mean? There's really no desire for it. It's just if he can swing a nice 4-iron and put it on the green, that's good enough. You know what I mean? That
he doesn't need the homecoming queen. He goes for the homecoming duchess.
Yeah. So anyway, but these are individual differences, and yeah, he has lived his life with a very pleasant degree of self-confidence, but this is different than the whole different kind of achievement process that where there's just an awful lot more chips in the game. But these are individual differences in personality. There's not a wrong way to do this life or the right way to do it. The right and wrong have to do with how we intelligently attack the problems or the competitive problems that we personally are facing.
And being able to discern the difference between accurately detecting, I'm getting my clock cleaned on the basketball court and I don't have the medal to be an NBA player, and having that be an authentic, set of data points that are coming into the system and informing your CB going forward versus getting ego trapped by it, which looks superficially similar, like, I can't play with these guys and so I'm not going to try. And so that, that's when you really need to know yourself and to know and to step back from how you were evaluating those data points and what your goals are and making sure that those are reasonable to know for sure that you are accurately responding to the situation and not just putting yourself in a competitively avoidant trap of some kind. And that's a subtle distinction for a lot of people.
That's super important, Jen. That's a, there's a feeling that comes when it's the pride feeling when you've done your absolute best and it's just not good enough for the competitive problem. You know what? This is what John Wooden talks about, what he means peace of mind.
You have to know that you've left it all out there and that's a distinct feeling that you have to get to know in yourself, because you don't know what it is until you've experienced it. So you have to cultivate it and experience it and learn to recognize it in order to prioritize it and chase it. And that's what we spend a lot of time talking about. Yeah. Yeah. Peace of mind.
Peace of mind. Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All so right, Nathan.
Yeah.
What else we got?
Dr. Lally, it's not like you altered your goals and you're like, all right, I'm going to do something else and not basketball, where some people might just go back to playing neighborhood ball just to get the feeling that they're the best, and they basically go to a different village where they're top of the top. Right.
Totally legit. In other words, if you like the process, and you like the process, then you go play where you can play and that you can contribute or even star. There's nothing in the world wrong with that. You found your limit. You found out what league you belong in. Go play there. I remember, I think it was Jack Nicklaus, when he was probably 53 or 54 years old. When you turn 50, you're allowed to go to the senior PGA. And when he turned 50, he was not ready to go, because he's like, forget it. He was still competitive with the younger guys on the PGA Tour. He had won the Masters at 46. And so he still had a lot of chops, obviously one of the two greatest players to ever play the game. No surprising that at age 50, this guy was still pretty damn competitive. And the seniors wanted him out there because they wanted more money and more attention to the senior PGA. And Nicklaus was the biggest star that there was. And Nicklaus said, trust me, these highly competitive people aren't necessarily the most pleasant people. One was a big part of my life for 50 years, and you guys know who that is. Okay, they're not necessarily that pleasant. Okay, and Nicklaus said right to the cameras, "Why the hell would I do that? Those are the same guys I've been beating my whole career."
Yeah, I'm not ready to give up on being challenged.
And so, about 4 or 5 years later, and 5 years more on his aching back, Jack Nicklaus decided to start playing in the senior PGA. and he was a star. And he didn't win every time, but he loved it again. You know what I'm saying? And it was like, it was now appropriate, and it was no longer, you know, he was ready. But that's what it is. You whatever it is that you love to do, you want to do it well. But if you can't reach the goal that you would like, okay, then we find out what there is next in line for your life experience. Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Had to get the golf story in there.
Yeah, got to get it in there. I got a couple sports stories in. Got them in there.
Well, when we did the show last time, it was I remember spending a lot of time talking about disagreeable basketball players. So it's all good.
Yeah, Michael Jordan. How Michael Jordan would be confident on the court, but he wouldn't necessarily be confident somewhere else.
Right. Yeah, that's a critical thing that I did mention here, is that confidence is not a general personality characteristic, although it can look like it. Okay, but it is actually not. So Michael Jordan, if you put him in a room with, five really, really smart math whizzes and said, okay, listen, the six of us have to figure out this math problem involving orbital mechanics and quantum theory, and we're going to have to do that in the next 90 minutes. Okay. How much confidence would he have? He'd be saying, you guys just tell me, you know, when you need a glass of water, I'll go get it for you. That's what he would be doing. So that's how confidence is. The narrow derivative of cost-benefit analysis with respect to a certain topic. We tend to think of it as, well, competitive issues of survival and reproduction, so the biggest, strongest, handsomest guy ought to be damn confident. Yeah, he's damn confident until we put him on roller skates, okay? And now suddenly he's like afraid of looking like a doofus, okay? So remember, the feeling of confidence is... It looks like it's broad spectrum, because so many of the problems of life have the same genes that are involved in solving those problems. But it is actually fundamentally very narrow. It's a narrow computation of cost-benefit analysis with respect to a specific goal. And so we don't give our kids, quote, general confidence. How much general confidence that they're going to have is going to be a derivative of their life circumstances and their DNA. Okay? But what we care about is the processes that Jen and I talk so much about. It's challenge, self-esteem, ego trap. Those are the things that are the important thing to make sure that we don't actually rob these people by cornering them with some motivational problems into a life that isn't as rich and as good as it can be. That's the issue. And that means them facing times when their confidence is shattered. That's part of the game.
Wonderful.
All right. Oh,
thank you, Dr. Lau. Thank you, Dr. Hawk. Learn something new every time, every podcast with you both.
And when it's the same questions, same show.
Even with the same question, yeah.
All right. What else we got?
Okay. Dear doctors, can you help me with imposter syndrome? I was recently offered, seemingly out of the blue, a stellar opportunity to work at the highest tier of my industry that I'm yet to complete training in. I'm high conscientious, high agreeable, high neuroticism, above average intelligence. After weeks of stress and emotional turmoil, not to mention hard work, I pulled off a great presentation and have been flooded with esteem and positive feedback and people wanting to work with me. Not solely because of the presentation, but my name must be getting out there in my field. I'm in a permanent state of bewilderment and anxiety. I can't seem to internalize, accept as true, and enjoy my success. I feel like a fraud, and that new clients are overestimating me and will be disappointed. Please help. These feelings are crippling and are inhibiting me from moving forward. This is my third career, and I have not experienced anything like this before.
Yeah, this is very similar to the last question in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I know some things that come to my mind, Jen, but what are your first thoughts?
Yeah, I would say that, imposter syndrome, we can talk a lot about this in a lot of different ways, but this is a dynamic set of experiences, much like confidence is. So somebody is going to be more or less prone to feeling something like imposter syndrome, depending on how... far they have extended themselves beyond their zone of confidence, essentially their perceived mm-hmm. probability of success, like we're talking about with the last question. And so, but like confidence as well, some personalities are more susceptible to this than others. And so you've described with your high conscientiousness, your high agreeableness, your high neuroticism, and your high intelligence, which is looking at this from all sides of the problem and putting yourself in a lot of other shoes, kind of looking at, you know, with a top-down view of the situation, which is something that IQ does. You are feeling like you were right at the limits of your capabilities and perhaps have pushed a little further beyond them, and your perceived probability of success has declined, and so you have a personality that is prone to something like imposter syndrome, and it's come sweeping onto you. The fact that you haven't had it before in your previous careers tells us that this is a dynamic response to this particular excellent high status that you've gotten from this job, and it has just put you into a situation that is a little too uncomfortable for your particular nervous system. And there are certain personalities who they have to find a balance between these things. They can be very driven, very capable people who desire a lot of achievement and success in life. But, you know, their personality gets really flooded and overwhelmed by those high expectations that come with high responsibility and high status. And so it's not always the best thing for someone's life experience and life happiness to necessarily get themselves into the highest possible job that they could obtain through their skills and through their accomplishments. That's why we call the show Beat Your Genes, because you have certain characteristics of your intelligence and personality and capabilities that are going to get you to that position in life. But once you get there, your neuroticism and that conscientiousness are cornering you in a way that has you living a life that is much, you know, has less potential happiness than just one tier below that. And that's just the real truth for some people. It's the same reason that a lot of people with the same kind of personality type, especially the high neuroticism, the women in particular, do much better in a relationship where they are a little bit under-rewarded. And so it's not necessarily the best, most exciting relationship that they could potentially get, but their nervous system is more settled down, being a little more under-rewarded, being the one who is wanted more, not feeling in that position of insecurity and relative powerlessness in the relationship. And that is something that they discover through several rounds of being in relationships where they're over-rewarded and the anxiety is just so overwhelming, the jealousy is so overwhelming, they can't deal, and it's actually causing them a higher level of unhappiness than they would forfeit by being in the slightly less exciting relationship. So it's a similar kind of thing for people who are predisposed to these sentiments. It's very exciting that you were getting this feedback and that you have this hard-won status achievement, but it could be just kind of a position that is too much for you personally. And you have to kind of choose whether you go down one step on the ladder or live in that state of discomfort, essentially.
Frickin' great co-author I drafted.
For that book that we're so ego-trapped about writing, but yes.
I would say two things. That's such a unbelievable cinematic answer to this. I was going to say that the first thing that I would do practically would be go after all those expectations with a hatchet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So that's my practical response. Your practical response is, you know, vastly more sophisticated. But my attitude for this individual is, listen, you created a monster, okay? And so your job now is to hack that monster to pieces. So it's like, hey, listen, you know, I don't know if this is going to work, or maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. This is just the best I have, okay? Hey, I think Jones is probably better than me. Try him first. If he's not, you know, if he doesn't have room for you, come back to me and I'll do what I can. In other words, you start figuring out how to dial down the expectations. That's one way to try to maneuver out of the current little crisis that you've got yourself in. you want to throw cold water on everybody's expectations. You know, if you put them up there from your presentation, and you're not sure you can fulfill them, you kind of put yourself in the situation that Jen's talking about. It may be well within normal people's risk tolerance to have made those kinds of commentaries and with reasonable probabilities of success, but with a high conscientiousness, now it's going to keep you up late and you're in trouble. And that can swallow your existence between your agreeability and your conscientiousness and your IQ. You can be in an swirling cauldron of 18-hour-a-day thinking, trying to figure out how on earth you're going to live up to these expectations. So the most elegant way short-term is to figure out how to throw cold water on them. That's just start thinking that thing through. Think about a position of power that you know, a hotshot attorney that is known to be outstanding comes and has some client that has a big, possible, juicy case. And the attorney walks through the door and says, okay, you know, you're in a hell of a mess. And the people on the other side are going to be great. And I don't know if I'm as good as they are. Okay? But if you hire me, this is what I'm going to do. And I have no guarantees that we're going to win it. And we may be in times during this, you've got a case and there's an argument to be made. And this is how it is that I would make that argument. Okay? I don't know. And we will, these are all the jury deliberate, this is all the jury assessments that we can possibly do. Well, you've got, $400,000. We're going to run all kinds of simulations all over places where people don't know what we're doing. We will analyze the hell out of this. But hey, I don't know if I'm your guy. I.e., take it or leave it. No guarantees. Okay, that is a I.e., if we wind up in shit and I don't pull this out for you, you've been warned.
I don't know if that works for somebody who has real imposter syndrome wiring in their personality. I've been in this situation many times as someone who's very prone to imposter syndrome, and I do that. Yeah. You know, it's like you've been warned, yeah. And it doesn't help me during the process when, you know, as the attorney, you're retained and they say, oh, okay, I understand. You're still keeping yourself up at night. You're still self-doubt every
right.
You feel like a fraud every step of the way, and it's a miserable experience. And so,
God.
So for somebody who's really in that, I think the only thing you can do is to somehow bring yourself back to a level of sanity. Yeah.
That's fantastic, Jen, because what you're really describing in there is the agreeableness.
It's the agreeableness. Yeah, no, that's a good
because,
point.
Yeah, because the agreeableness and the conscientious, like I'm sufficiently disagreeable that I'll go in there and hit him over the frickin' head and let him know, no, I don't have any great expectations for success here.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you exactly what I think, okay? And all you're getting out of me is my best shot, and I'm telling you right now, I don't know what I think of it. Okay, that's how I handle that. But if I was more agreeable, I'd be picking up cues that they desperately want to see me as a hero.
Yes, yeah. And I'm going to do everything. I'm going to take everything personally and do everything I can to please them anyway. How much it costs me in the short term. And that's a tough place to be. I mean, I've had friends that I went to grad school with who... You know, mm-hmm. they got hired before they'd finished their dissertation at some hotshot, you know, assistant professor at Stanford or something. And they're just immediately totally in this imposter syndrome craziness where they can't even they stop producing. You know, they can't finish anything. Mm-hmm. They can't finish the dissertation. They can't finish a book. They get sort of just absolutely terrified, like a cornered animal. And it's this combination of factors, and it's personalities like mine, and it sounds like hers, which are just, you know, so afraid of disappointing people, and you know, kind of inherently overpromising, and, you know, trying to warn and, but not believing that they take the warning seriously and all of these things. It's just a tough position. And I've seen it really crush people. And so, so, I mean, it's, but it's really at odds with this, like, hey, I earned this. I mean, it's not like you, you got this, you say you were offered this job out of the blue. Well, it wasn't out of the blue. It's people looking at your work. It's people evaluating what you're capable of. And the fact that your name is getting out there and people want to work with you. I mean, sometimes I tell people who are deep in imposter syndrome, you need to start a you know, open up a document in, on your laptop and start writing down every time somebody says something positive about your work. And put a date there, put exactly what they said. And, you know, force yourself to look at this record. Like, because imposter syndrome is all about kind of feeling like, oh, they made a mistake, or they're just being nice, or they're just saying that, or they don't really understand, or they didn't really, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But when you're confronted with a, you know, 9-page document of all of these nice things that people have said, and all of these compliments and all of these good reviews and et cetera, that can kind of help combat a little bit of the feeling that, you know, oh, if only they knew, if only I'd be found out, and they'd, you know, they're going to come after me with pitchforks and torches in the night. So that's one thing that you can do, but it's tough when you have that sort of ambitious personality and you're capable of accomplishing really good work and people see it and recognize it and want to reward you for it. But you've got to choose happiness, you know, you got to choose happiness before success. That's what the wisdom fork is about. And I suppose there are personalities out there that can forfeit happiness for success and live that way. But most women are not like that. And most agreeable people are not like that.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's oh, I have a sports story on this.
Oh, good.
Oh, too bad, Jen. Too bad. You went on too long and it, I pulled it out of my files. So it turns out
let me know when you're done.
I think we'd have to look back. It was probably about 8 years ago on the cover of Sports Illustrated magazine. It shows a big kid soaring. And I think it says the Andrew Wiggins era. And this kid, Andrew Wiggins, I think it was out of Kansas, was seen as the next big thing in basketball. And he was chosen number one in the NBA draft. And I think he's about 6'6", and he can jump out of the gym. Incredibly great kid, just super hardworking. Anyway, he was chosen number one and expected to be, I think he went to Minnesota, I think. And so he was expected to be, you know, i.e. the Michael Jordan coming out of there. And a few years goes by and everybody finds out, you know, he can go out there and score 27 points a game, but he's just not that good. He will do it. He will be your number one star. But with him as the best player on your team, you're not going anywhere. Like, you're an okay team, but you're never going to be a great team. You're not going, this team's going no place. And a couple of years ago, he was traded to the Golden State Warriors. And at Golden State, he came in, and he's clearly not going to be the best player on the team. He ain't going to be the second best player on the team. He may not be the third best player on the team, but he's sure as hell the fourth best player on the team. And Andrew Wiggins now in this playoffs, his fellow players, he's in an incredible basketball environment in Golden State. There's probably never been a better psychological environment, you know, of a championship team, probably anywhere in any sport ever. It all starts with Steph Curry, who's an unbelievably gracious superstar and super unselfish just inherently, and Klay Thompson, who's his buddy. And Draymond Green, who is a guy who is incredibly unselfish offensive player and just a tough, tough character. Those guys love this guy, and they see his magnificent capability that just wasn't quite enough to be, you know, the big thing in basketball, but he is an incredible addition to a championship team. And you're seeing him, and they have said to him, he's a very quiet character, but he says, this is a dream come true. He's not being asked to go out there and get 30 points a game. He's asked to be, you know, a complementary role player and an extremely valued one. And he's having the time of his life. And, you know, if the odds makers are right, Andrew Wiggins will this year be an NBA champion. So if he's not, it won't matter because he's found the right place for him. And it's with the expectations not too high.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
there
that's,
go,
that's a very...
How,
yeah,
how,
these...
How many mails did you get through?
All right. It was a useful sports story, sort of. two sets. Yeah, I'm on my next coat. No, it's true. And that's the same sort of thing of my friends who, you know, once they were basically run out of their very high status, you know, assistant professorships and didn't make tenure, that they wound up at some tier down the track. You know, they're at some, not necessarily a community college, but they're not in an Ivy.
Oglethorpe.
And yeah. and they're much happier. You know, they get to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond. And it's sort of, you know, it's the right sweet spot for their perceived probability of success and their ability to get meaningful status from other people. I mean, it's still, you can't go so far down the tier that the status that you're getting about what a great job you're doing doesn't resonate and doesn't matter, because that's again, this kind of psychological no man's land where if you're working in a useless job doing useless things for a useless boss and your boss thinks you're the greatest thing since sliced bread, that is not esteem in the right way from the right people, you know, that matters. It's not going to improve your happiness. Your happiness is going to come from getting esteem in the right way from the people who matter. But this might be just a little, you're flying a little too close to the sun for you to be able to sustain that. And so you say something in the question about how you haven't, just for practical advice for this person, that you were offered this job in an industry that you have yet to complete training in. I wonder if you are still engaged in that training or if the training is on pause to take the job, or I'm just thinking this through as an agreeable person. If you can kind of big Louie your current position a little bit by saying, hey, I just feel like there are some skills that I really need to polish here before I take on these kinds of clients. And, you know, I feel ready, but I just want to make sure that I'm bringing my absolute best to this. And I think I still need 6 months to finish this training or whatever it is. I don't know the specifics here. But that is a way to kind of save face in this whole thing, where you put these big clients that you're feeling are going to discover what a fraud you are on hold a little bit, and say, hey, I'd love to work with you and keep me in mind, but I'm actually... You know, I need to complete X, Y, and Z before I can take you on. You know, really, really glad to connect and let's keep this relationship going. But in the meantime, you give yourself a little bit of breathing room to kind of carve out a place that makes a little more sense for your particular nervous system and isn't putting this much pressure on these aspects of your personality that are going to cause a lot of trouble.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hawk. Thank you so much, Dr. Lyle.
All right. Very good, Nathan.
Awesome. All right.
All right. Well, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so, so much. And we'll, you know, summer's around the corner. We'll look forward to talking to you both next show.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah,
all right. Back to the
back
farm,
to,
Jen.
Back to the farm.
All right. All right. Well, I'll call you in a
and
few days
to
and get a crop report.
All right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, very good. Right, very
great.
Good. Okay, I'll send you all the
All right,
details.
Everybody.
Okay.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.